afternoon, good evening. If you tuned in tonight to listen to Arab Voices, they have been preempted tonight because the state of Texas has decided to use this time to execute Reuben Cardenas. My name is Ray Hill. The name of the program is Execution Watch. I am merely the host here. And I regret coming to the radio station every time we do one of these shows, because we always hope in advance for there to be a stay. But when there is not a stay, we are obliged to cover the execution of someone in the death chamber in Texas. We are awaiting calls from our Huntsville reporter, tonight that's Linda, is up there, Linda Hugan. And Dane Grant are in Huntsville tonight as a team to tell us about what's going on with the witnesses crossing the road. I see producer in there scrapping around, and so I'm going to burn up time until she gets us a reporter from Huntsville on the air. The Execution Watch has been on for 5 or 6 years. And we have been on that long because the Texas practice of killing people has been going on a while. It first started with just Elizabeth and I and some out-of-tune, out-of-town, or out-of-sequence people to interview. And we talked about the case that was being thing. And then along came a fellow by the name of Jim Skelton, and he said, you know, what you really need is legal analysis of the case. And so that expanded to include lawyers. There are now 4 lawyers in the studio with me, and they will be sorting through this case. I will introduce each of them before they speak. They're going to tell me what happened in this case and what happened in the trial, or whatever the trial was, and what happened on the appeals, and why all of that failed and lead us to this point of an execution. So we have someone in Huntsville on the line. Could you put them on? Linda, is this you, Dane?
It's me and Daddy, yes.
Okay, you're on the air.
Okay, nothing is happening here so far. We're just waiting.
There's no witnesses crossing the road?
No, and there's still some stuff in the Supreme Court that is, has not been denied yet.
Okay. Are there any vigilance out there for this occasion?
Yes, there's a lot of people out here. There's the a lot of media, and there's media witnesses that are going to go in, but they haven't even been told to come to where they're going to go in at. So,
okay.
And the Mexican consulate is here.
Okay. Well, the Mexican consulate is there.
Yes.
Why don't you just stay on the line? Let us do the billboard, and I'll come back to you.
Okay, that's
okay. Can you hang on that long? Is that going to run out of batteries on your cell phone?
No, I'm fine. I'm 100% charged.
Okay, so let's do that, Robert. You can do the billboard, and we'll come back to Linda. Put Linda on hold.
Reuben Cardenas is a prisoner in Texas. If the state has its way, he'll be dead within the hour. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world, where prison staff is preparing to put Cardenas to death by injecting him with a deliberate drug overdose. During the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will broadcast live coverage of the killing in Texas, the state responsible for more than a third of all U.S. executions. Execution Watch host Ray Hill, with criminal defense attorneys Larry Douglas, Mike Gillespie, Jack Lee, and Paige Gianni. Huntsville reporters outside the death house, Linda Hugan and Danny Grant. Houston Vigil reporter, Jennifer Simmons. The Execution Watch for Reuben Cardenas begins.
Well, we are back, and put Linda back up. Linda?
Yes.
Okay. Where in relationship where you are, where is the Mexican consul?
The Mexican consulate, they are right over here.
Can you put him on for a minute?
Yes, I can.
And,
yes.
Okay.
Somebody talk to you on the.
Mr. Consul. Okay, we're waiting on the Mexican consul in.
They can't.
Yes. Hello?
Yeah, they said they can't talk to you right now.
Okay. Well, if they can't talk right now, so that's the way that it is.
They said at the end they would talk.
Well, that's not the way our schedule works, but thank you.
Okay.
Okay, and there's still been no action crossing the road.
No, nothing yet.
Okay. Is there any counter demonstrators there?
We haven't seen anybody here that's for the other side. No.
Okay. Then, well, I would suggest that you be prepared to call Elizabeth back if any action does happen.
Okay, we certainly will.
Okay, and I appreciate y'all doing that. By the way, Linda, you are part of the staff of the prison show, and that is on Friday nights at 9 p.m. on this very same station.
Yes, we'd love for everybody to listen.
And so if you want to know what communication is like between death row inmates, other inmates, and their families, the prison show does that, as well as a discussion of prison-related issues that changes from week to week. Is that accurate?
That's very accurate, yes.
Thank you, Linda. We will talk to you if something else happens.
All right, thank you.
Okay, bye. That was Linda Hugan, and she is a volunteer on the prison show, and that comes on Friday nights at 9 p.m. on 90.1 FM. And so let's get Jennifer up. Jennifer, where are you in this damp darkness?
Yes, hello, Ray. Well, it is cold and rainy here, quite an unusual night for us to be vigiling in Houston. It seems like it's been a long time since we've had such bad weather for this. But we are at the corner of Maine in Benz, next to the Methodist Church. I've got a beautiful statue of Jesus on my right in the Art Museum on my left. So what better place could we locate here for our vigil?
Well, I can report to you that the witnesses have not crossed the road.
Well, that is good news.
And so there's still something pending at the Supreme Court of the United States. And whenever you get through with your reporter, including telling me something about the coalition, I will explain what that means to the audience.
Sure. Well, I am here with the loyal members of the coalition, the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. These specific vigilers are sisters from the Dominican community, very loyal always. And it's just a very cold, dark, wet, miserable night here in the beautiful, some call it the heart of Houston, next to the block from the Meekin Fountain. So we hope that we will get that phone call from you that says that this vigil will not take place.
All right. How do people get in touch with the coalition?
Well, we're at tcadp.org. That is the website of our central organization based in Austin. We will have a wonderful convention. They're always late in February. I urge everyone to come. It will be in Dallas this year. It rotates around from place to place. And we have Facebook pages, too. So just go on Facebook and use that and look for the Texas Coalition. There's a Houston chapter page, and it'll tell you everything you need to know.
Thank you, ma'am.
Okay. Good luck, Ray.
Good night. Yes, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Now, what we've got is we've got no witnesses crossing the road, so that means there's something pending before the Supreme Court of the United States. Texas cases go to Justice Alito. We've gone from going to Scalia, but he died somewhere in Texas like the people that are being killed in Huntsville, but he died in somewhat more comfortable conditions. And then for a while it went to Justice Thomas. And then whenever they got the new justice, they did another reshuffle, and we wound up in the hands of Justice Alito. Now, Justice Alito looks through the case. There is a clerk at the Supreme Court of the United States who does nothing but capital cases. And he knows all there is to know about capital cases. However, the justices involved are the ones that have to make the decision and not the clerk. So he reports to and answers questions to Justice Alito. And then Justice Alito has the option of deciding on the case, thumbs up or thumbs down. I envision that. It's kind of like one of those Colosseum things, thumbs up or thumbs down. Or he can say, wait a minute, let's get a posse here, and they pull in other justices of the court to consider this case and make the decision kind of collectively. Surprisingly, Justice Scalia frequently called in other justices of the court.
I don't know if that's really that surprising. Scalia, while he definitely has his opinion, he values discussion. He values opposing opinions.
I got his vote in Hill versus Houston.
Yeah, I mean he's not afraid. He thinks on his own. He's a critical thinker, and he makes decisions based upon what he his analysis of what is right.
And rather than just jump to some kind of conclusion and draw his own thing, he may say, wait a minute, I want to talk to Ruth Bader Ginsburg about this before we proceed. And he has the right to do that if he is the go-to guy.
Sure.
So Alito is in the same seat, and the last time we had a delay, we had an execution later on. There's a fuzzy question at this point is around this table. Do you think, as lawyers study the case, each and of you get ready to join this, including Jack, including Mike, do you think this case is going to proceed?
Yeah, I do. Generally speak, I mean, this case is fairly cut and dry. It's there really are no controverting facts. There really are no.
Well, wait a minute. There's that consular thing.
Well, that consular thing, that's a procedural issue.
Okay.
Okay. And what I mean is there's not much question as far as guilt innocence is concerned. There are some procedural issues, and the problem with procedural issues is that there's a fairly large mountain that you have to climb in order for procedural issues to stick.
By the way, if you were listening in, tuning in KPFT again to listen to Arab Voices, they have been preempted tonight. They will be back in this space next week. Paige, what's your call?
Oh, I agree with Jack on this. I do not foresee a stay. Instead, I believe that the execution will go forward. I find it curious, however, that the Supremes should be fooling with this case because there are no apparent issues that the United States Supreme Court would jump on as coming out of this.
So it's your estimation that we're waiting for Alito to finish dinner.
Well, I doubt if it's a dinner thing.
Time in Washington, D.C.
With another one of the justices on the Supreme Court, yes, we would wait for his dinner. But, no, I don't think that's the
Larry?
Issue here.
Ray, I'm notoriously terrible in terms of trying to predict what the outcome's going to be.
But you know this case. You've had a look at it.
I know the case.
Because I'm going to come to you for the facts.
I am encouraged, though, by the time and attention that is being expended on the final decision of a man is scheduled to die. So, and there is no rush to get that this done. So I'm encouraged by that. But whether they will come up with some reason or persuaded that it shouldn't happen tonight, I don't know. I suspect that it will. That's my guess. Okay, I wouldn't call it a prediction. It's just my guess that it probably will happen tonight.
Okay.
But there is still time for them to reflect and to decide that maybe for whatever reason, this is not the night for Reuben Cardenas to die.
Mike?
We're all caught up in terms of the Mexican issue, which is the issue of a foreign government, and I think the courts have taken care of that. This is a case in which he gave a statement the day after. He acknowledges all the facts. The interesting part to me is it took 1 year for this case to go to trial from the date of the murder to the date that he was given death penalty was less than a year by a day.
Yeah.
And yet it was been 20 years on the appeal. What I don't understand is an issue that we've not talked about yet, but the issue that his lawyers bring up about DNA testing. Well, we all knew that DNA was just coming on the scene when his murder was committed. I'm not sure when DNA started, but
yeah,
the late 1990s, 2000.
Sure.
But it just seems to me that all of these legal issues about counselor and counselor's rights and did he have a lawyer, the bottom line, every man on death row should have the right to have a DNA sample.
Well, you know, I'm prejudiced, really.
Yeah.
I don't think. I wish they'd all get stays and we'd never have to do another show. But the deal is, in this case, we have a delay at this point. Now, while we've been talking, something could have changed. It's just that Linda hasn't called in to tell what's going on. But they will ultimately call, and a light will flash in front of me, and I'll see that there's some action, something happened on the board, and I'll be able to get back with him. But right now, there's a man who is on the gurney. He may not have the needles in his arm, but he is laying there looking at the ceiling, awaiting.
And it just strikes me.
To go ahead to die. And that encouraged me that in and of itself is certainly unusual and probably cruel.
The fact that they're waiting this long and making this decision tells everybody something's going on. But again, I want to address this issue. If this man said he didn't do it, why don't we have a DNA test? It's a simple, simple procedure. If there's no DNA evidence in this young girl, he couldn't have done it.
Okay, we're gonna get into the facts of the case in just a minute. But let me. Let me go to Larry. Larry, what the hell happened here?
Well, Ray, we're here because this is a capital murder. That is, Reuben Cardenas has been found guilty of committing an act of murder in the course of other felonies. First, there was a kidnapping,
mm-hmm.
And then a rape, which is known under Texas laws as a sexual assault.
Yeah.
And then a killing, a murder.
So there was a series of felonious activities resulting in a homicide.
Exactly. We've gone through several death row cases, and in this case is uncomfortably routine as far as I'm concerned in terms of the issues that are not brought up. I mean, Mike's talked about the DNA, and we talk about all kinds of issues. This case is just the routine nature of it. It's based on a confession, a statement.
Okay.
And if the statement that there's some corroborating evidence clearly, but if the statement given by Cardenas is true, then he's guilty of capital murder.
Yeah,
but
if
it's not,
let me make this: you can't just go in and say I did it and wind up on death row. You've got to have a trial of the evidence, and evidence has got to corroborate your confession.
You can't plead guilty.
Can't plead guilty
to a capital murder. there's got to be a trial. But in this case.
Now, if it were a life sentence, he could do that.
If it were non-death, yes. Yes. That can be negotiated. In this case, 26-year-old Ruben Cardenas, back on in February 22nd of
1997.
According to him, what happened was he went to his cousin's house, his 16-year-old cousin Myra, and she was in the bed with her sister. Went into the home, kidnapped her, tied her up, walked her out. And then riding around with his buddy, the two of them rode around for a while drinking,
hanging out, and
they'd been already out drinking before, but police officers stopped them earlier and told them they were too intoxicated to be out, gave them a break, said, you know, you guys need to go home. They didn't go home. So told Cardenas he shouldn't be driving. He said, let your buddy drive. Another guy drove, but then Cardenas starts driving again. And according to him, he tells his buddy Tony Castillo, you want to go and kidnap somebody. And Castillo goes for it. And according to Castillo, and then there's some controversy as to what all the specifics were, but the evidence admitted at trial.
So this is really not a pretty case at all.
It's not a pretty case, but the thing that concerns me, even though the facts are terrible, there are a lot of terrible cases in this country, Ray, and yep. We don't seek the death penalty on every one of them. Could Cardenas been fined to spend a long time in prison, if not life?
What happened to Castillo?
Castillo went to prison. He got 25 years, and he's eligible
still
for parole. He's still there now, but he's going to be eligible for parole pretty soon. But what supposedly happened is, Cardenas takes his first cousin out, and then there were some witnesses. The sister who said she saw a person in a mask. The neighbor who says, I saw a person leading a little girl who had no shoes on, seemingly to corroborate that. They didn't identify Cardenas. Okay, the people who identified Cardenas was Cardenas himself and his buddy Tony Castillo. But in any event, after he ties her up, takes her out, goes to a concealed area. Now, Castillo claims that, you know, when I found out how terrible things were getting, you know, I hauled. I ran away. And there was some controversy. Well, did Castillo stay there through the whole thing? Which Cardenas says, yes, Castillo stayed there through the whole thing. But the whole thing was a 16-year-old girl
raped and murdered.
Being raped. And then Castillo says, Cardenas says, well, she fought me, and I fought back. And she lost consciousness, and I tried to resuscitate her, but it didn't work. So when it didn't work, then I rolled her body into the lagoon, to the water where she was found. Okay, but as Mike's pointed out, you know, this is all testimonial by primarily the unique testimony. The unique identifiers are not from the neighbor, not even from the sister. Okay, the sister who's also Cardenas' cousin. So they didn't recognize him. The neighbors didn't recognize him. But everything comes through the statements that were received by law enforcement the very next day, initially,
and
from Cardenas.
And there's not a Miranda issue here?
He went in voluntarily. In order for the statement to be admissible, he has to have been given his statutory warnings, which unfortunately just go over so many people who are the focus of an investigation. That is, you have the right to remain silent. It's amazing the number of people, including lawyers, who don't take that advice and keep their mouths shut.
Not necessarily, especially in Hidalgo County.
Actually, anywhere, Ray, anywhere, if the police want to talk to you, okay, about something, the best thing to do is to say, I want a lawyer. That's
yeah,
that's
for
the
sure.
absolute
no,
best
no,
thing
no,
to
no.
say.
No, there's no doubt in my mind about that. Last detective said, Raymond, we want to talk to you. And I said, well, I got to have Stan Snyder in my lap.
it's bad if a person has actually committed some offense. It's worse if they didn't commit any offense at all.
Yeah.
But there seems to be something that suggests that the person did. And the numbers of false confessions, people who, because the interrogators, I mean, these guys are good. Okay. They had him there for hours. I mean, he's 26 years old.
Yeah.
Not this, you know,
he's not a punk
not,
kid,
but
maybe a punk, but not a kid.
But still at 26. And if he's never gone through this before, I mean, he'd never been to prison before. Okay. So having never gone through anything like this before, thinking he can just explain things away, and with these guys keeping him there for hours, after having warned him, but keeping him there for hours and then getting more and more and more out of him. And this wasn't the only statement he gave. Okay, he gave another statement later. Okay, and again, if the statements were admitted.
How long was it before he had a lawyer in this
picture? I'm told it was 11 days after the incident.
And then he kept on talking.
Well, yeah, and the number of hours, the days, the weeks, is not really critical. The critical thing is, did you have a lawyer before they tried to examine you or after? Because once it's after, there's not a whole lot a lawyer can do. So it's only before, and they got to him right away. They focused on him right away. How they focused on him so quickly, I'm not sure. But they're talking to him the next day.
All right. So this happens in like the first 11 days, and then within a year, they've got a jury and a impaneled.
Jury impaneled and trial completed. Okay, and sentence imposed.
And do you know
in
anything
about
that trial? Obviously, guilt or innocence is not a big deal, but what about the punishment phase?
There was really no issue. I didn't see anything on appeal as regarding the punishment.
And that concerns me also because
it's automatically two phases.
Correct.
Right.
You've got guilt and innocence, and well, that's a done deal with all these confessions and from both the defendant and the co-defendant, and all that's going on, and that seemed to be pretty lucid. But then there's got to be a punishment phase.
But we look at the appellate record, Ray, but the thing is, the thing that concerns me that we don't have here, that we talk about all the time in death penalty cases, are the death factors, the future danger and mitigation. Future danger and mitigation. We didn't see those raised as particular issues, and that concerned me.
This guy's got no criminal record. We don't have any indication that he's been in trouble before, other than maybe got stopped for a traffic ticket and got a break on that. The future dangerousness is.
That's the thing that concerns me when you look at the appellate record. I mean, I don't see those issues as having been raised. That is this kid a future danger, and are there any mitigating circumstances that should spare his life? Because that's really where the bread and butter is of death penalty cases. Is the person of a future danger a person with no prior prison history?
And those are not just casual phrases. The state is obliged to prove those elements.
The state is obliged to prove the future danger, but then the defense, okay, is their job is to bring
up
the mitigating circumstances. And so typically at appeal, no, those are the things that would be discussed. Is future danger and mitigation, and the appellate record, so far as I've seen, seems to be devoid of those, and it just leaves me wanting. Is this really a death penalty case, or what is it?
The only issues that appeared in the original appeal to the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals all concern guilt or innocence. None of them involved future dangerousness or mitigation. I echo what you have just said. I did not see a single opinion talking about future dangerousness or mitigation.
And that's the thing that concerns me. That concerns me.
It becomes the Candyman case all over again. The nature of the crime was so horrendous that...
No, well, the courts actually ruled that in that
case. Yeah, but what I'm saying, it's the same issue. Here's a man with no criminal background.
And again, it dealt with his relatives. He killed his kids.
Mm-hmm. But the Candyman was, the facts were so outrageous, by definition, is future dangerous. And same thing with this. There was no history of any criminal activity. There was no violence in his past. But he's got black tape with him. He's going with somebody who wants to watch somebody be killed, break into a bedroom and kidnap a young girl and rape her and murder her. That becomes just like the Candyman case. Those facts became all they needed to hear about future. Now, I'm not agreeing with
it. If you're trying to, by the way, audience, if you're trying to keep up, there have been no jaywalkers across 13th Street in Huntsville, Texas.
And I'm not agreeing with it. But I'm saying
that is the same theory, I
think they did in the Candyman.
You know, we come into this room and we deal with things that are uncomfortable to deal with for us. Some of these cases are worse than others, and this is a pretty egregious case. Now, but somewhere along the lines, there ought to be a scorekeeper that turns and says to the defense lawyer, you're not doing your job, and so there are mitigating circumstances and you're not presenting him. Maybe there are no mitigating circumstances.
But look, as I started saying before, take away all the issues. Is it his DNA in that young girl? If it's his DNA in that young girl, everything else is a moot point. But anybody who's due to be executed has got the right to have a DNA sample, especially...
But the thing is,
at those times, technology wasn't there. As long as a sample was preserved, anybody should have the right to have a DNA test done. If it's
The last time we were in this room talking about Robert Pruitt, and they kept saying, well, DNA test the offense report found on Robert Pruitt. And the Supreme Court of the United States chastised them and said, do that DNA. They never did that DNA. They DNA test the murder weapon. And they don't find Robert Pruitt anywhere on it.
All of these,
so they ruled that DNA test was somehow inconclusive.
Mike, the problem that you're running into here is that his confession was so incredibly detailed. It pinpointed where the body was. It pinpointed
that. And apparently convincing.
And convincing.
I agree.
And all of these, and, you know, if it's a guilt-innocence issue, everything that they have, defense has to show that there is a reasonable probability that the conviction would that it would show innocence. Frankly, DNA or not DNA, one, he convinced. Two, his confession had so many details that nobody repeated except for him. Even without DNA, if DNA testing didn't exist, they would convict him. It's a but-for, and simply, let's presuppose DNA came back and none of his DNA was found. So what? You still have a confession. You still have a dead body.
My point is, maybe with the DNA sample showing that it was DNA, all of these issues about the Mexican consulate would go away because nobody would have anything to complain about.
Well,
and now all we're doing is open it up where people can make complaints.
Who's got that load? What happened to the Mexican consulate?
Both Mike and I are going to talk about that.
Okay. Well, y'all got microphones, so have at it.
We're talking now about the international treaty. And the international treaty, and what basically says is that when somebody from any country is arrested, that they've got the right to have counsel from their country advise them before proceedings start. The purpose of that is so that people know the ground rules of the country they're in. If you go to a country in which there is no right to not testify, if you go to a country where you're arrested, you're going to go to jail, you might feel you need to talk. In America, you don't need to talk. these are the kind of things the counselor would inform somebody that in America, these are the rules you play by. So even though the international courts have said these are valuable rights, the United States Supreme Court has not blanketly, I think there were like 60 originally in the first lawsuit, 60 Mexican nationals to be executed. The Supreme Court would not inviolate every one of them, but the U.S. Supreme Court said we will look at every case on a case-by-case basis to see if a counsel had been called up front, if there would have been a difference in the case. And what they have found in none of those cases would have made a difference. And just like this one, they're saying that the fact that a counsel wasn't called up front doesn't make any difference because all a counsel would have told him wouldn't affect any of his rights.
And that's what you were talking about when you said but for.
Right. And, you know, let me put this into perspective, okay? Let's suppose there's a search warrant, and the search warrant says 1060 West Addison, which is the which is Wrigley Field.
Okay.
Okay. 1060 West Addison, and I get arrested at 1065 West Addison across the street. That is a defect in procedure. That's a defect in how that they went to the wrong house. They went to the wrong address, and I still got arrested. That's a defect that that is critical to all the evidence that they were able to gather against me.
Okay,
let's
back up on that.
All right.
Okay, you got a search warrant, and a search warrant is pursuant
let me finish.
To an affidavit,
right?
By a credible source.
What I'm driving at here is that, let's suppose I was at 1060 West Addison, and the police officer who served that warrant on me jaywalked. Who cares if he jaywalked? It's not like there was a defect in the material information that was there. It was a defect in how, you know, it was a minor diversion. It was a minor problem in getting it to me. It wasn't a, you got the wrong address. That's a big deal. It wasn't a, you got the wrong person. That's a big deal. It's a, the police officer jaywalked. And that's kind of what we're talking about here. When the Cardenas not getting information, not being told, hey, you can talk to your, you can talk to the consulate if you want to, okay, would talking to the consulate have changed anything? And when the Supreme Court came out and said, look, we're going to take this case by case, when it was appealed by defense, the Criminal Court of Appeals was about ready to issue an opinion and then said, hold on, we're going to take a look at this case again in light of this new opinion from the ICJ and the opinion from the Supreme Court.
Maybe my misconception is I thought that those talk to the consul things was an international treaty agreement, because when Americans get arrested on foreign soil, we want them to talk to their consulate. And when other people from other countries get arrested on American soil, we ain't got time to mess with this crap.
Well, in a perfect world, everybody would tell everybody else. But the problem that you run into with the opinions from the International Court of Justice, the ICJ, is that it has no it's not binding to anybody. It's not binding to anybody. If Congress went in,
is that
and
what treaty means? We hope you'll do this.
No, treaty has to be ratified. Any treaty has to be ratified by Congress in order for it to, and have a federal tie-in statute in order to have it, in order to have the force of law.
This doesn't.
This doesn't. You know,
pull your microphone over.
This doesn't. It does not have the ratification, nor does it have the force of law, nor does it have the enabling tie-in.
So it's just
statute.
A nice thing we say.
It's an aspirational goal.
All right. So you're telling me that the three college basketball players that just got busted in China had a nice aspirational goal before they were made bond and got out, right?
It's like Syria having signed on to the climate change. for the next several decades, Syria will have no way of enforcing their ability to their treaty agreements.
Because they're fracking.
They're just not. It's hopeful. It's window dressing. It's aspirational. It's I want a pink pony for Christmas.
You know, it's tough to just take this at face value. Larry, I thought these things meant something, and then when it comes down to actual case, they've got a perforated edge.
Well, you
can tear them off.
But the countries that signed the Geneva Convention, they've got to decide how they're going to implement it in their own countries. In this case, when you look at what the Geneva Convention would have provided to Cardenas, is that is the ability to consult with the consul from Mexico. Well, what good would that consulting have done? Would they have provided any kind of lawyer for him? Would they have assisted him in defending against the case? There's no telling what would have happened, but in this case, the local courts decided that the apparent violation of the Vienna Convention was not going to would not have made a difference.
Would not
in the
have
case.
Made a difference. But, in that
but when you get to the straight capital murder, okay, there were issues raised like jury selection. Lawyer was complaining about that is appellate counsel about the fact that the having to have death qualified jurors and those who expressed reservations about the possibility of imposing the death penalty were excluded from the jury. There were a lot of things, and in a death penalty case, the primary concerns are life and death. Is there some way to save this person? Once guilt is decided, then it's a matter. The whole issue is this the kind of case that deserves the death penalty? That is, the facts were terrible facts, but facts of murder are always terrible facts.
Yeah, there are no pretty places.
And the mere fact that you can use that evidence as evidence of future danger. It just appears that, well, you know, where is the one contesting future danger, and two, where is the mitigation? That's the thing that concerns me most about the case.
It's not the murder. It's
good.
Breaking.
Might get closer to the microphone.
It's not the murder. It's the worst nightmare of everybody. Somebody broke into your house and stole your daughter.
Yeah.
That's the crime.
I mean,
that's not the murder.
That's legend.
And that's cold-blooded. Calculated, coming in, breaking in, taking the window pane out, coming to the bedroom, carrying her out, tying her up, walking right past witnesses, complete disregard of human life, and then taking her to somebody who tells you they want to see somebody killed.
All right, if the consul thing is not an issue. All right,
the consul thing is not an issue.
Not an issue.
I mean,
consul
it's a.
And this is an ugly case. We accept that. What's the delay?
That's what I'm wondering. What's the delay?
Why are we still sitting here?
I've been checking the web.
What?
Well,
who filed it? Was it the Mexican consul?
No. No, it appears that that Cardenas's attorneys have filed the United States Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
An application for a writ, and
application for a writ. In other words, we got an idea,
yes.
And we want time to formulate it.
State of Texas has already responded to it.
Mm-hmm.
And the defendant's lawyers have filed a reply to the state of Texas's response. And this has all happened
in the last 24 hours.
Well, actually, it's happening on the web right now, all within 46 minutes, because this was not on the web.
When we began.
But realistically, I would imagine that Mr. Cardenas's lawyers filed this morning, bright and early, right, Eastern Standard Time, with the U.S. Supremes at like 9 o'clock in the morning,
right,
and everything proceeded from
having
there.
Having served Texas prior to filing,
yes,
which is the protocol. Everybody knows here it comes, and then it comes.
But Ray, I think you're correct in focusing on the Vienna Convention, because if it's being looked at again at this late hour, then there may be some overriding international political considerations that might require it being looked at just one more time. Is there something going on geopolitically that would suggest that we need to tread carefully? That might be what's going on. I have no idea, but it's a possibility.
One of the things I don't really
something
like.
I'd like to point out about about, you know, I mean, there is this argument that, well, the United States, we're very barbaric in the fact that we are okay with executing people.
I mean, this is an anachronistic activity.
Sure. And, you know, Mexico, for example, does not execute people.
Right.
France will not extradite to the United States if it's an execution case. Okay, unless execution is taken off the table. I'd like to point out that this whole argument about how barbaric the United States is in our criminal justice system with the death penalty, it smacks of extraterritoriality during the colonial times.
Sure.
One of the European arguments against their people, against Europeans being tried for crimes on foreign soil. You're a European, you commit a crime in Indonesia, or in the cases that I'm familiar with, in China. Well, we don't want you to be tried under Chinese law or Indonesian law or Malaysian law. We want you to be tried under English law, French or German, and so on.
That was the deal in Iraq whenever we pulled so many troops out of Iraq.
Right.
Is because we couldn't get any guarantees from the
Exactly.
Iraqi government that
Exactly.
that American soldiers were not facing Iraqi law.
Right. And there were wars fought particularly against China for these specific reasons, and hence there were carved out colonies within Chinese soil. European colonies, colony states were carved out in Chinese soil. And now we look back at the tradition of extraterritoriality, and we think, oh my goodness, this is such a barbaric colonial imperialism. And in much the same way, it's the same logic that gets to us that a lot of folks are using with, oh my goodness, the United States is so barbaric. It's for lack of better words.
Okay, we got a call. Put them on.
No,
we don't.
For lack of better words, if you go to a different country, you should probably try to stay on better behavior, because their laws are not your laws, and what you're familiar with is not what.
I'm comfortable with the Constitution of the United States. I don't know if I'm comfortable with the
implementation.
The Constitution of the United States in Pakistan, or the Constitution in
right.
Pakistan. But I know what the Constitution is
sure.
in America. And if they don't apply it, I can appeal and get
sure.
it applied.
Sure.
I've done that.
And in this case, it was applied.
But, you know, here we are at the literally last moment, actually past the last moment.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to go off the air in 10 minutes because this event has not progressed as far as we know. Elizabeth's on the phone right now, so I may have more information for you in shortly. But the deal is that why play this game of chicken at the last minute? What's that about?
I don't really believe it's chicken so much as it is human nature and our desire for procrastination. And I think that if you just look at us.
It's like kind of like the military, hurry up and wait.
Yeah, or like a teenager looking at their parents and saying later. I mean, it's the same sort of issue when you're,
I get kind of involved and emotionally involved in these circumstances of execution. I mean, this is something.
Well, I do understand that, Ray, but I can't, as an attorney, I cannot make the appellate judges act to suit my clients.
And they don't have timelines.
And they don't have
timelines. You have timelines, but they don't have timelines.
Exactly. I mean, I've got a drop dead date on a filing, and it could be possibly extended for 6 hours,
but no more.
But generally, I'm not going to get a 72 hour extension after the fact. I could get a 72 hour extension before the fact if I asked please and said thank you, but you know.
Well, apparently something may have come up that Alito has said, all right. In the last minute, we got these motions and we had the state respond to it. And then somebody responded to the state response to it. And it's just kind of like a monkey motion that it just goes on and on and on. Meanwhile, somebody is in the death chamber on the gurney. Now, they're not going to put the needles in his arms until it's over. Mm-hmm. Whenever the courts finally say ex nix, the end of this argument is over, then they'll put the needles in his arm. As soon as they put the needles in his arm, then the people will cross the road, because that's a secret ritual of needling the arms, because they don't always needle the arms, because sometimes if they're drug addicts, those particular veins are worn out, so they have to go in elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And so
the femoral artery or something.
Yeah, come in through the neck. Mm-hmm. I remember one execution that one of the witnesses came out and said they had the needles in the guy's neck that attached to his brain from his heart. And so, Ruben Cardenas is now alive. The prison show is reaching the end of its cycle. We have no additional information about the witnesses crossing the road. Still believe they're going to kill him, Larry?
I suspect they will, Ray, but I'm hopeful, just like so many other people are, that there's something out there that the court wants to take a look at.
Paige, where are you?
Within the past 24 months, we have had one execution that occurred when the United States Supreme Court got involved again at a very, very late stage in the procedure. And that execution, I'm sorry, I've forgotten the name of the defendant.
It went 10 o'clock.
But it happened at about 10 o'clock, 10:15.
It's three executions ago, whoever that was.
And in any event, so we have had one in recent memory that has happened after 7 o'clock. It's just that generally they walk them across the road at around 6:15.
Well, they walk, you know, if everything's cut and dry, they walk on the road at 6 o'clock.
Yeah.
First word we get is the witnesses across the road. Jack?
I don't, in this case, I just don't see really anything that defense can hold, can really sink their teeth into that hasn't already been litigated. I just don't see anything that defense can raise which would be convincing.
Mike, you want to weigh in on this?
Yeah, well, same thing everybody's saying. Of all the cases for the Supreme Court to act on, this is not one that I see. I expect they're going to execute him as we say. The part to me which is interesting is you talk about cruel and unusual punishment. To be tied in that gurney this period of time waiting to die, and now they're going to reprieve you and let you go through the whole process again?
Oh,
you shouldn't have to do it twice.
Over the years. Because I've been watching this longer than y'all have, because I've been doing this show before y'all got here. And then before that, I had Friends on Death Row that I watched. I've seen this happen multiple times.
It's almost like the Twilight Zone.
Okay.
The witnesses have still not crossed the street. And it's time for me to do a wrap. You're listening to The Execution Watch. My name is Ray Hill. And the radio station is KPFT in Houston. If you tuned in to listen to Arab Voices, you got something very different from that today. I want to thank our witnesses, Linda Hugan and Donnie. They are in Huntsville, and they have been able to keep us advised that the witnesses have not crossed the road. Ruben Cardenas is, as of this moment, still alive. My name is Ray Hill. The lawyers' names are Larry Douglas, Michael Gillespie, Jack Lee, and, of course, Paige Yannick. Paige has carried her into the weight tonight. Thank you, Paige. Appreciate you doing that. And Jennifer Simmons called in from the Museum District for the Houston Vigil. The producer, of course, is Elizabeth Stein, without which we can do nothing. We're helpless without a producer. On the board is Bob Gardner. Our technical director is Otis McClay, who maintains the website and all of that. And the voice you hear in the background is Victoria Panetti. Her brother is still on death row. He is severely mentally incapacitated, but they haven't cut him loose from those responsibilities. We won't be back until December the 12th, I think. December the 12th, when they've got another execution scheduled. My name is Ray Hill, and good night for now.